live from the 860 AM studios in the city where great things happen, Philadelphia. This is Unexpected Goals. I'm Rich.
And I'm Rusty.
And we have a lot to talk about today as the global world of soccer is on an international break. We're going to change up our format today, Rust, and at about 10 after the hour, we'll have an interview that we recorded last Thursday with Mark McKenzie of the Philadelphia Union, the Supporters Shield champions, winners, Philadelphia Union. Great conversation with Mark. And congratulations to the Philadelphia Union for not only being the best team in Philadelphia, but also the best team in MLS in terms of putting up the most points in the regular season. They won the Supporters Shield, so congratulations to owner Jay Sugarman, to Captain Alejandro Bedoya, and to friends of the show, Coach Jim Curtin, Sporting Director Ernst Tanner, Brendan Aronson, Jack Elliott, Ray Gaddis, Matt Fries, and how can we forget Erica Shear, our media liaison and an absolutely first-class professional, and all the people in the organization, way to go. So we'll discuss where each of the leagues are, who are the surprises, who are the disappointments, who is going through a phase, and who really should be worried. The key players this year for clubs might not even be the players. Without a summer break and with an intense schedule of matches, players are getting injured at an increasing, if not alarming, rate, Rust. At this point, the most valuable people at the club are the medical and training staffs. This is not a small issue. For some clubs, a very big one. Our awards, as usual, we'll get to them earlier. We have the Man Bun Player of the Week, the Tweet of the Week, and could it be those of Man City fans declaring victory for the season? And the leader in the Endangered Manager Sweepstakes. We also would like to wish a happy Veterans Day in advance to all those who served our country so nobly and so bravely. Veterans Day will be observed tomorrow or on Wednesday, November the 11th. Also, a reminder that we are on social media, so check us out on Twitter at UnexGoals and on Facebook, just look for Unexpected Goals. Follow our personal accounts, too, at Rusty_Gorlick and at Gorlick Rich. And we also would, just before we get to our soccer birthdays with Rusty, we'd like to give a word from one of our sponsors, SafeHub. SafeHub is a nonprofit organization running soccer-based youth development programs at Lighthouse Fields in Kensington, North Philadelphia. SafeHub works with over 100 kids in North Philly to provide high-quality out-of-school time activities for kids using soccer as a conduit for personal development and leadership building. SafeHub focuses on creating safe spaces for healthy relationship building with peers and coaches, especially for young people that might not have access to these support structures in their daily lives. SafeHub is rapidly expanding, projecting to triple their participant reach in the next year, with the right support. To get involved or to donate, visit usa.safe-hub.org. So, Rusty, soccer birthdays today.
Soccer birthdays. It's a loaded day for soccer birthdays. 1 month before my own birthday, just putting that out there. But
And yours is going to be a big one, 21, so there you go.
Yeah, exactly. So, João Félix also turning 21. Today, he's the Portuguese wonder kid who Atletico Madrid bought from Benfica for $134 million a couple years ago. He's having a great year so far this year. Eduardo Camavinga, the Angolan-born French national midfielder who plays for Rennes and has star written all over him, turns 18 today, which is nuts. Dan James, the backup right wing for Manchester United, is 23. Wilfred Zaha, the Ivorian international, who is the star of Crystal Palace, is 28. Alexander Kolarov, the Serbian left-back who has had a great long career and has one of the best left feet in all of football. He's a former Lazio, Man City, and Roma player, now with Inter Milan. He's 35. Oliver Torres, a central midfielder for Sevilla and a former Atletico Madrid wonder kid, turns 26. And last but not least, Jens Lehmann, former Schalke, Arsenal, and Stuttgart keeper, as well as German national team keeper, turns 51. So, big day. But
is that our best birthday day, Rust? Is that our best birthday day probably since we've started doing the show?
Yeah, I think that is. I can't really recall as many players, like as many big names in one day as we have here, because from Lehmann to Zaha and then the next generation with Félix and Camavinga, I mean, it's really solid.
Give you a great 5-on-5 team in a cage at a Banlieue with these guys.
Yeah, oh, for sure. But Rich, where the should we start with the Premier League now, or should we wait till
No, I
after
think
Mark?
what we should do is go to our awards, then we'll go to Mark
Right.
McKenzie today, and then we'll come back with the major leagues in Europe. How about that?
That's a good call. So,
So,
shall we start
Rusty,
with the Petit Award?
the Petit Award, the Emmanuel Petit Honorary Man Bun Player of the Week Award, da 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 da. Who gets it this week?
So it's an honorable mention this week for Theo Walcott. He had a great game and an assist for Southampton against Newcastle in a 2-0 win over the weekend. But the winner this week, he's a first-time winner of RB Leipzig, which is one of the main man bun teams in Europe, is Marcel Sabitzer. He's the second Leipzig player to win it this season after Yusuf Poulsen. He had a goal and a hockey assist in a 3-0 win against SC Freiburg and made four key passes. Great performance from him. Very underrated player for a very good European team.
Well, Rusty, I'll say this. Theo Walcott proves you can go home again because he started out as a youth at Southampton. And Marcel Sabitzer, by the way, he's on my Zlatan Ibrahimovic, Sead Kolasinac, tough guy team. You know, the guys who you want, you know, if you're getting into a van and two guys come wielding pistols or knives, is what happened to Kolasinac and Mesut Ozil about a year ago. Good work in doing the digging. And Marcel Sabitzer is a player who might move on at some point from RB Leipzig. You could see him as a number eight in the Premier League at some point.
He could, but also, I mean, the fact that he's still there, Upamecano's still there, shows that RB Leipzig's building something special. But moving on to the first manager to get sacked in the English Premier League sweepstakes, Rich, who is the leader right now?
Well, Russ, I suppose what's volatile, what's amazing in the volatile world of football. The Bundesliga saw two of its 18 managers sacked within the first couple of weeks of their season. No manager has been sacked yet in the Premier League, which makes this discussion all the more compelling. And we will check to see what the record is for the latest the season has gone without a Premier League manager being sacked, but we must be close to approaching a record. Last week, I said that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had taken the lead after some bad performances in the Premier League and a disastrous one in the Champions League, even though they are tied for the lead in their tough group in the Champions League, but only to read that he has the full backing of the ownership of Manchester United. Well, almost at the same time reading that United had talked with Maurizio Pochettino's representatives, and there was some interest in RB Leipzig's Julian Nagelsmann. So I think that Ole has to give up the pole position for now because he's safe. So right now, for me, it's a two-horse race between West Brom's Slaven Bilic, whose club just couldn't see out a draw against Spurs this weekend, and Burnley's Sean Dyche, whose patience with his ownership probably is less than his ownership's patience with him. But right now, I'll pick Slaven Bilic because I think West Brom just looks a bit hapless right now, and I think he needs to get a win on the board or else he could be gone. So with that, Rusty, we have our newest feature, the soccer tweet of the weekend. And this takes some doing, by the way, for our listening audience, because it's not like we have, you know, a bunch of interns from Temple University, although they are welcome to join us, scouring the Twitter sphere for the snarkiest or silliest tweets. We kind of just happen upon them and see what gets retweeted a lot. And so, Rusty, without further ado, what are the tweets of the weekend that you found, and who's the winner?
So I thought that Southampton's official club account had a good one. It wasn't the most original, but given the proximity, they just tweeted a picture of the league table with them at number one and then tweeted in all caps, "Stop the count." Seems like low-hanging fruit to me, though. So the winner is one that hits home for a lot of our listeners in the Philadelphia area. MLS journalist and host Andrew Wiebe tweeted a thread on how the Philadelphia Union's knockoff Supporters' Shield trophy came into fruition. So basically, they found out that the web manager's fiance's sister's boyfriend, the web manager's fiance's sister's boyfriend, owned a very legit Captain America costume in Medford, New Jersey. So the Union drove to Brendan Aaronson's hometown to pick up the shield. They attached a Supporters' Shield decal to it. They had to use pressing irons to do so, but the pressing iron got stuck on the shield because of the strong magnet. This wasn't a Halloween costume. This is a legit Captain America costume. So the strong magnets on the shield got the heating iron stuck to the shield, but it worked out well because I thought the shield looked great in the celebration pictures. Great thread from Andrew Wiebe. So that just made me laugh because that is absurd and also the most MLS story that anyone could think of.
Right, because anything can and will happen in MLS. It was a great thinking on the fly by the Philadelphia Union because the real shield got stuck in the mail. And that's why they didn't have it at Subaru Park. And so good job digging for you. It was fun to see that story unfold on Twitter. And, of course, just adds to the celebration that the Philadelphia Union so richly deserves. It's continuous improvement happening under Jim Curtin's tenure over the past 7 years. And, Rusty, that's a good segue to our interview of the week. The Philadelphia Union have been busy people with matches and hopefully getting ready to celebrate. And there's an international break and they could get some rest. And we were fortunate enough to be able to sit down late last week with Mark McKenzie, number four for the Philadelphia Union, their star center back, probably the next American to get a good contract with a European team, and just having a wonderful season with the Union. He's from Delaware, and it was just a very enjoyable time to talk with Mark. So we're going to go to that interview right now, and when we come back, we'll talk about a lot of the things happening with the major European leagues.
We're back live on Unexpected Goals on 860 AM in Philadelphia, Talk 860 with Rich and Rusty. And we're pleased to have Mark McKenzie, center back for the Philadelphia Union. Mark, thanks for joining us on Unexpected Goals.
No, thank you for having me. Thank you for having me.
Mark, it's great to have you. And we love to talk with people about how things are made, how things get started. Can you take us back and tell us how you got interested in soccer when you were growing up?
Well, my dad's Jamaican, so, you know, I think it kind of ran through my veins in some way, shape, or form. But, you know, they put a ball at my feet, well, my dad did at least, and I had always had a knack for sports growing up, but ultimately I just found a natural passion and love for the game, you know, and from there kind of just made my way.
At what age did you figure out that you were really talented at the game and that you could go far with it and perhaps even professionally?
Probably say I was fully devoted at probably about 6th, 7th grade. I was coming up to King of Prussia for pre-academy training with the Union 3 times a week. And then and got even more intense, you know, by the time I was a freshman in high school and full time with the Union's Academy.
Who were your heroes growing up? Whose games did you try to emulate?
It's kind of difficult to say because, you know, prior to joining the Union, I was a forward. So I loved Thierry Henry. He was a guy I loved watching. I watched his highlights all the time and kind of emulated his game when I was a forward. But as I made my way towards, you know, the back line, it was more of the Carlos Puyols and the Maldinis, the Nestas, you know, the Cannavaro and the Sergio Ramos. So these guys who I kind of watched, you know, coming up and learned and just the basics, one of defending, but two, the beauty of it as well.
So was it any bit of a bummer? Being a soccer fan, sometimes the strikers get more of the glory. Deep down, was it any bit of a bummer when they told you were more suited to play center back than, say, striker?
For sure. It was definitely difficult, you know, to say the least, you know, going from scoring the goals to having to defend striking, scoring the goals. But, look, I found a natural – the coaches saw something natural in me that was more of a defender than I was a forward. And ultimately, like, they get paid the money to recognize the abilities. And, you know, from there, I just kind of made my way and found my way as a center back.
Mark, did your play as a forward from growing up, did that help inform you maybe as to how to be a better center back?
For sure. You know, understanding the movements of strikers and what they like to do, you know, being able to break down, you know, an opponent in their game, I think those are just a couple of things that kind of helped me as a center back, being able to pick up on movements prior to happening and knowing, you know, what tendencies that forwards do have. You know, if one's lazy, you know, what does that look like? One is more hardworking. How do you defend against that? So, yeah, definitely helped.
So when you entered the Union's Academy, what was that like in terms of changing, you know, your approach to the game and also just in terms of changing your life?
Yeah, it was, you know, one, being full-time with the Union, that was a full-time, you know, job in a way, you know, as a young guy, as a young player. And from there, you know, I think it adjusted the way I viewed, you know, just about every aspect in my life, you know, of making sure that if I want to achieve something, I got to put my all into it. You know, as much as you can't have a plan B, you know, understanding that if you're not committed to plan A, you know, plan B is simply going to be, for you, it's going to be, you know, a fallback, and you're going to pull away from devoting your time to that plan A.
That's fascinating. I mean, that concentration at such a young age is just so impressive for the fans. I think that it's more part of a European culture. It's increasingly part of a U.S. soccer culture. And that leads to the next question, which was, you're in the academy. Obviously, you were playing with, like, the U.S. under-15s and under-18s and what have you. And then you decided to go to Wake Forest in North Carolina, as opposed to, say, staying in the area or going the professional route. What prompted that decision?
There were many factors that kind of went into it, but the biggest for me was having the ability to get to be at a prestigious institution, receive a top education, but also play, you know, quality football as well. So I think for me that was huge. Understanding the importance of getting a degree, you know, in my family. You know, my family are big on education, you know, and understanding that, you know, your time as an athlete, you know, is kind of short-lived, but having a mind that is keen and sharp, having a mind that is full of knowledge, something that nobody can take away. So that's, you know, that went into the decision. But I always had the back, you know, had the dream in the back of my mind of playing professionally and understanding what that would take. So whether I be attending Wake and getting my degree after 3.5 years, but playing ball as well, or ultimately taking the route I did and attending Wake for a semester and ultimately signing pro. But to this day, still getting my education, you know, working towards my degree, which is only a little under a year away. So.
Wow, that's awesome. And what prompted that decision, you know, Mark, to leave Wake after the semester and to go pro?
I think it was my intuition for me, you know, was a decision that I that had been kind of bubbling inside from the time I left the academy and attended Wake, and understanding, you know, that everyone's path is different, and having seen some of my teammates from the academy sign professionally, you know, and that I was going to take the college route, but ultimately, you know, not giving up on that dream of being a professional footballer. And when I was at Wake, I had gone through some difficult times of not playing and being on the outside, which was definitely frustrating, but I was away from family, and I really had to roll up my sleeves and understand that it was going to take a lot more than simply some pouting, you know, to get back into the picture. And ultimately my time came at the end of the semester during the ACC tournament, and helped the team through to an ACC, you know, tournament championship and the Elite Eight of the NCAA tournament. By that time, I had really that feeling of wanting to go pro had gotten to a boiling point, and from there I had to make the difficult decision to leave the school, and you know, pursue my dream.
Seems to have been a great decision. I mean, I think with writers, even with actors and with other people, you see a lot of resumes where people stayed for a year because they got discovered or they decided that they really needed to go hone their craft in a different environment that focused much more on the profession, whether it's music or acting or athletics, than staying in college. And you know, even going back 3 years, Mark, MLS used to celebrate the college draft and have a big TV show around it and maybe even over the internet. And then all of a sudden you saw the Union trade off its draft picks a couple of years ago. And I think under, I forget who it might be Tab Ramos when he was coaching one of the under-21s, no one from the most recent under-21 team was a college player. Mm-hmm. So what has transformed in the U.S. soccer culture to make the academy so much more important and college soccer less important when it comes to turning pro?
I think it's kind of been the growing influence of football in the country, from the grassroots level up. You know, we see how the biggest players are playing in Europe, and we see how football in the United States was lacking and behind in many instances. But all it takes is one domino to get the dominoes falling, right? So now we're at a point where clubs are, like the Union, for example, are hosting and bringing international players in the academy setup, and now grooming them to you know, be ready for the senior team, for the first team. So I think that's been a culture shift. You know, the growing influence of the game we see in LA, you know, we see LAFC and how they have gone from zero to one of the best teams, because they are invested in developing the best players, but also bringing in the best players, bringing in the excitement of seeing the game in its most beautiful form. I think that's kind of influenced where we are now today. And again, the European setup has been kind of tailored to fit the accommodations here in the United States, but again, it's growing and it's growing rapidly.
The transformation of that culture and of the quality of play in MLS has just been terrific over the past 5 years. The union team you play on just has gotten better and better during Jim Curtin's tenure as head coach. And what do you attribute the continuous improvement to at the Union? What's the atmosphere like in the locker room and in training sessions?
It's one of we have a nice balance of veterans and youth as well. So I think that plays a key role in why we are where we are today. You know, I think the energy and the joy and the fun lovingness of having the young guys in the locker room and the jokes and whatnot balances out some of the veterans and the difficulties that they went through to get to where they are and the wisdom and the experiences that they have. So yeah, I think they kind of balance out our locker room. You know, so we have a good mix of how to get through difficult times, but also how to enjoy, you know, the good moments as well.
Well, Mark, our viewers, our listeners are mostly American. So the question is, you know, what age is a young guy in soccer? I mean, at 21, are you a young guy or middle-aged guy? What are you?
I consider myself a young guy, you know, like the middle part of young. We have guys on the team who are born in 2003. So you know, this is young is a relative term, I guess you could say. I'm 21, so I'm young, but in terms of the career of a footballer, I'm working my way into my mid-20s, which is usually around your prime for your career, and then from there it's you're a veteran or older player. So yeah, these are relative terms I'm using, because in regular day life we don't necessarily use 21 or seeing 21 as like a middle age. You know, it's different. But yeah, we have some young guys on the team, to say the least.
No, I just remember seeing a story in ESPN years ago about a running back in the NFL who was, say, 33 and was considered very old. And every time he showed up at preseason training camp, they sang happy birthday to him to remind him. How does it feel having a chance to win the Supporters Shield and the team is going to the playoffs? So how does it feel right now for you and for the team?
Feels great. You know, I think we came off our first playoff win last year against Red Bull, you know, at home. I think that kind of set the tone for the group and seeing, you know, how when we were, you know, firing on all cylinders and we were working together as a cohesive unit, you know, how we were balancing each other out, how successful we could be. And I think the best teams are the consistent teams, you know, who do it day in and day out, who do it on a weekly basis. And I think that is what has helped us get to where we are now. You know, having the experiences of last year and being a number one for so long and then getting knocked out in the conference semis by Atlanta in Atlanta, you know, it puts us now like we want to be number one so we don't have to travel to any other clubs in order to play a match. We want to have teams fly into us. You know, we want to set the tone. We want to influence. We want to influence other teams to change the way they play. So I think that that attitude, that mentality, has really shifted and helped get us now to where we are now. And we would ultimately like to have secured Supporters Shield, you know, or had some more security this past Sunday against Columbus, where we ultimately lost. But like, we get to do it now at home in front of our fans. On our turf and on our terms. So we control our own destiny, but we're looking forward to the opportunity. We will have to rise to the occasion.
Do you and the guys take pride in the fact that you're the best team in Philadelphia?
I think we do. To be completely honest, I think we do. We feel that we don't get enough respect amongst the Philadelphia teams, you know, and we look at how much success we've had over the last few years and how little recognition we've gotten. But that's what that chip on our shoulder that we have, you know, nobody likes us. We don't care. I think that was a mentality. That was a phrase that our coach in the academy used. And that's kind of the Philly mentality. So, you know, we may not get the recognition, but we're going to, you know, do what we do. We're going to, you know, keep fighting and we'll let the rest handle itself.
Well, the attention certainly has been on the rise, just in terms of you know, people, what you see on social media and what you see on the following of MLS, and even locally. And just a couple more questions because I know you have to go. You've played on national teams at various age levels. You had a call up to the men's national team within the past year, and we all know the story of the disappointment of the U.S. men's national team going into the 2018 World Cup. They just couldn't get across the line. Much has changed since then, and you know, in your estimation, how good is this supply of players? How tough is the competition for spots, and how far can this club go?
Yeah, I think the club can go only as far as we, you know, as we want it to go. If we're not all bought into the process and bought into fighting on a daily basis to be successful, then we're going to fall short. You know, but ultimately we've been in positions to succeed, you know, time and time again. But now it's about executing in the most difficult times and the most the pressure cooking times is what I like to call them. You know, when we're in a playoff match like against Red Bull and we're down 3-1 at halftime, what does that look like? And we also can come back and win 4-3. What does it look like now in a game where we're in Columbus in difficult conditions, you know, with the potential to raise a trophy, you know, on the road, and we fall short? You know, now we have to execute, you know, in this next match, you know, in order to be a great team, we have to be able to do it on a consistent basis. And I think that's what is ultimately going to help us, you know, achieve that dream of ours to be a great team, you know, to be a team with a hefty trophy case.
That's just awesome. And then one final question about Mark McKenzie personally. There have been stories and speculation that after Brendan Aaronson, you could be the next player to go to Europe to further your career. What is your timetable for that? And are there any particular clubs that have been following you closely? And if I know this is a sensitive question.
Yeah, no. I mean, look, there's all kinds of speculation and rumors out there, but look, Greg, I give you the generic answer. You know, right now I'm focused on helping the union in any way I can. You know, we got a trophy on the line coming up on Sunday. So you know, that's where my focus is right now. And then ultimately helping the team, you know, get to the MLS Cup. And raise it. I think that's most important. So that's kind of got my attention, you know, for the time. But you know, also the dream is to play in Europe at the highest levels. You know, I've seen the rumors and I've seen the speculation and the interest and whatnot. But again, I'll cross that bridge once we you know, lift some trophies. So I'm not gonna get too far ahead. You know, kind of just focus on right now and enjoying this present time. When the time arises and I'm ready to take that leap, you know, everyone, you guys all know.
Well, I'll be the first to know. Well, listen, Mark, you have a great attitude about it. You seem really relaxed and you're performing at a high level. And we just want to wish you much success in your future endeavors and certainly in upcoming matches with the Union. So thanks so much for joining us on Unexpected Goals. It's been a pleasure to have you.
No, thank you for having me. And, you know, guys, stay safe, stay healthy, and, you know, we'll see you guys soon.
You too. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
That was an interview that we recorded last Thursday with Mark McKenzie before the Philadelphia Union went on to clinch the Supporters' Shield with its win over the weekend against Montreal, against Rusty, fill me in. I'm blanking.
Oh, gosh. Who was it?
It was Montreal.
Was it Montreal?
Yes, it was.
It's New England.
New England. I'm sorry. Oh, my God. There have been so many soccer factoids cutting through. We say in our social media, Russ, that if you give us 1 hour, we'll give you the soccer world. And in our last half hour, we're going to give you the soccer world in terms of highlights from the four major leagues in Europe at the international break. And I'll start with the Premier League, and you can interject. I think the biggest stories right now, first are the standings. Who would have predicted this for your top four? Leicester City with a lot of injuries, Liverpool, Tottenham Hotspur, and then Southampton. That Arsenal would be in 11th and that Manchester United would be in 13th. And the answer is no one. The quality in the league is at its best ever. You can't buy a winner in this league, but you have to pay for one. And the last time we checked, there's a significant disparity, perhaps by a couple of million dollars a year, in the average salary paid in the Premier League versus the average salary paid in any other league in Europe, which is why the supply of talent is so good. A lot of good managers in the league, with the danger, of course, that all clubs are embarked on an arms race in the middle of a pandemic with a so-so global economy resulting from that pandemic, and the lower leagues are hurting. Another huge story in the Premier League is the season-ending injury to the best center back in the world, Virgil van Dijk of Liverpool. Many thought that would be a season changer in the Premier League and make Liverpool very vulnerable to not repeating as champions. That has not happened. Highlights and surprises, Rust. Marcus Rashford, member of the British Empire's performance off the field and helping ensure that poor children across the UK get the food they need. Leicester City at the top of the table. And Didi is out. Soyuncu is out. Vardy's been out. Madison is out.
Ricardo Pereira has been out.
Ricardo Pereira. I mean, they've all been out. And it's a major tribute to the manager, Brendan Rodgers. He gets my vote for manager of the year so far. Probably the best managerial job, not only in the Premier League, but in any league in Europe. Southampton is in fourth. This is a club, Rusty, that lost 9-0 at home to Leicester City last season about 53 weeks ago. And it seems.
Oh, but the thing is with that, they did lose that game, but also no broadcaster will let them live that down, because it seems whenever I watch a Southampton game, in the first 3 minutes of the match, that's being mentioned. But they have bounced back this year.
And they were terrible then, and then they rebounded to beat Leicester in January at Leicester 2-1, ended up finishing in 11th place, and rewarded manager Ralph Hasenhüttl with a new contract. They've gotten very good play from their captain, James Ward-Prowse, strikers Danny Ings and Che Adams, midfielder Stuart Armstrong, and winger Walcott, but they'll miss Ings perhaps until January because he did have to have knee surgery. And I think the second biggest surprise is Aston Villa, which almost got relegated last season, needed a miracle to stay up. And they did. They had issues at goalie going into the season and attack, and seemingly have rectified them with the additions of Emi Martinez from Arsenal, who might be the best goalie right now in the Premier League playing-wise, Ross Barkley from Chelsea, who has greatly upped his value, and striker Ollie Watkins from Brentford.
One thing about Barkley, though, is that he's been given a much more free role, I think, behind Watkins. He and Jack Grealish are sort of their two attackers, and then Watkins is like the proper striker. So it's interesting from an English perspective about Barkley, because most of the time, at least previously in his career, Barkley was sort of shoehorned into a box-to-box midfield role, probably because he's British, and in the Premier League, British players don't always seen as the most creative. But I think putting him in that free role has really made him a lot better, and is also a testament to the creativity, I guess, of English players and how they're not just supposed to be athletes. They can actually bring a little flair to their game. So that's good to see.
Yet another player excelling, moving away from Chelsea, Kevin De Bruyne and Mo Salah, of course, being prime examples. And then, Jack Grealish, you mentioned, I'm an Arsenal fan. He's my favorite player to watch right now in the Premier League. He's a leader out there. He makes things happen. He can really rally the lads in a way that a lot of teams could use that leadership.
Yeah, I think I've seen a few people and publications putting out headlines since that game against that their 3-0 win against Arsenal this weekend, saying that Grealish, if he's not the best player in the Premier League, might be the most valuable to his team in the Premier League, which I think is right, because at least last year there's a lot of Jack Grealish hero ball from Aston Villa. Luckily for him and Dean Smith, that's not really the case this year.
And he's playing, and he might be the player playing the best in the Premier League right now. And that's a stark contrast, because Sheffield United finished mid-table last year, and they were the big story of the promoted teams. And they didn't do this offseason what Aston Villa did. And they say the second year after promotion is the toughest one if you can manage to stay up. And clearly Aston Villa has done something right, and clearly Sheffield United has done something wrong. And then, of course, highlights Spurs and Chelsea seem primed for deep runs toward the title. Spurs have the world's, right now, to me, one of the best, if not the best, strike partnership in Heung-Min Son and striker Harry Kane. Chelsea had the best transfer of any club maybe in history and has a very potent attack. And Hakim Ziyech played this weekend and looks like he could be a long-range precision bomber, which, you know, just for opponents is something else.
He hardly got a look in until now, which is scary if you're playing against Chelsea.
Right. We got to wrap up on the Premier League so we can move on, because we will take about, say, 7 minutes for each league. Disappointments, Manchester United. Every time this club takes a step forward, it drops backward. Mo Salah has scored more goals in the past 3 years than Mason Greenwood, Anthony Martial, and Marcus Rashford combined, which underscores some of the problems up front. It's in 13th place after finishing third in last season. They got Bruno Fernandes from Sporting Lisbon in January, one of their best signings, perhaps their best signing in quite a while. He provided a spark they needed, but yet the team seems to lack a rudder. Greenwood's having problems in training. Paul Pogba seems lost, and he'll probably go after this season. It's like they have big pieces who are good and could be good on good teams. Maybe they don't fit together. Ole Gunnar Solskjaer's job is safe, but they really need to solve for their chemistry. And then I would think, Rusty, Manchester City has been disappointing. 10th place, a game in hand, 3 wins, 3 draws, 1 loss, has scored only 10 goals in those 7 matches, given up 9, and that really is a mid-table performance. In fairness, they've been without Sergio Aguero and Gabriel Jesus, their strikers, for a bit. They need to find their offense, because a healthy Aymeric Laporte and Ruben Dias, along with the third center back, Nathan Ake, that's the best center back combination probably on the planet. Ruben Dias, the acquisition from Benfica, and playing very well. And, you know, they've spent $500 million pounds on center backs within the past 5 years. So questions around Pep Guardiola, their manager. He's out of contract. Your buddy Phil Foden hasn't cracked the lineup yet. He comes on at the 85th minute.
Free Foden and free William Saliba. That's a different team, but still.
Okay, and then finally, just quickly, Arsenal, talk about inconsistency. At the beginning of the year, people were talking how they could finish in the top four. They're in 11th, and it's really not all that impressive in 11th. 4 wins, 4 draws. They frustrated fans last season by setting a record for draws, it seemed. They won the FA Cup and qualified for Europa League. They got couple great acquisitions, Gabriel Magalhães from Lille, who is right now on the top 11 for all players in the Premier League by a lot of writers, playing great at left center back and midfielder Thomas Partey. But Willian looks to be a bust, past his sell-by date, and they're struggling at attacking midfielder. Mesut Ozil has been banished to Twitter. Henrikh Mkhitaryan was banished to Rome. He had a hat-trick this weekend. They don't trust youngster Joe Willock, and they don't want to move Bukayo Saka from the left. So there's really no one to create in the middle. One game doesn't a season make after the horrible effort against Aston Villa, but this team needs to get unstuck, and there is confidence in Mikel Arteta. And then finally, we alluded to Sheffield United. Actually, they finished in 9th last season, but right now they're in last place. No wins, 1 draw, 7 losses, only 4 goals scored and 14 yielded. They're in deep trouble. Unless they really change something and Ryan Brewster, whom they acquired from Liverpool, does something in the attack, they will get relegated. So with that, Rusty, you know, there are other leagues in Europe, so why don't we go, as I am leafing through, to La Liga, and what stands out after 8 or 9 matches there?
Yeah, I mean, for me, the main standout personally is Ralph Felix because he's having a great year so far. But one thing that also stands out just on the larger table as a whole is just the disparity in the number of matches played between some teams. So Barcelona has only played 7, first place Real Sociedad have played 9. And even if you gave Barcelona 4 points from the 2 games that they have in hand on Real Sociedad, they still wouldn't crack the top 4. So they definitely have some work to do. I am not totally convinced by Ronald Koeman as the manager. I'm happy that he's getting some younger players playing time, but the attackers still look pretty out of sync, and it's just not looking like they can really make a realistic run to the league title unless Messi is playing like he was, say, I don't know, 5, 10 years ago. Right now, Atletico Madrid, I think, is the best club in the league. They've only played 7 matches, but they're in fourth with 17 points, have scored 17 goals and yielded only 2. The offensive part of that is certainly unexpected because they have never been known for their offense under Diego Simeone. João Félix is the biggest story for them. He just turned 21 years old, and he has 5 goals and 2 assists already this season. Luis Suarez already, he's their new signing, 5 goals and 1 assist for him. Marcos Llorente, who was converted from a defensive midfielder upon arriving at Atletico Madrid from Real Madrid. Now he's playing wing and second striker, which doesn't make sense, but it's working because he has 3 goals and 2 assists. This is without Thomas Partey, who left the Arsenal in the summer right before the transfer deadline day, and their captain, Saul, has only been available for 4 of these matches. So, yeah, impressive year for them. Rich, do you think that they'll be able to keep this up over the entire campaign?
Yes, I think they will. I think they're really formidable. I think that Simeone has evolved as he's had to. And next week for our listeners, we're going to have an interview with Eric Krakauer, the play-by-play announcer and commentator for beIN Sports, who covers La Liga and Ligue 1, to talk about both of those leagues. And he'll offer his opinions during the international break. I think they can too. And Rusty, also, Villarreal is in third place after 9 matches. Seems re-energized under Unai Emery, who was really run out of both PSG and Arsenal. And then
Who would have thought?
Granada and Cadiz are off to good starts in fifth and sixth. And Rusty, you have to tell us about the next American up, Yunus Mensah. What can you tell us about him?
Yunus Musah of
Musah, that's
Valencia.
right. Mensah is, an organization that wouldn't have either of us as a member. This is Musah. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'll have to ask about that later. But yeah, Yunus Musah, I mean, has had a pretty good year for Valencia. He's only 17 years old, which is Gio Reyna's age. And I mean, I think the good part is about the U.S. national team right now is there's not a ton of pressure on these young guys to really succeed right now, or even at the 2022 World Cup. I think the goal really is just to qualify, which I think the group is certainly talented enough to do. Musah is like an 8-10 wing hybrid. He's a pretty dynamic attacker from what I've seen. So yeah, there's certainly reason to be excited for him if you're a United States fan.
And what can you
But yeah,
tell?
we can.
And
Oh, go ahead.
that's great. And what can you tell us about the first place team, Real Sociedad, because they look like they're going to be in the hunt all season.
Yeah, I was just about to get to them. So great minds think alike. But they're in first place after 9 matches. They have 20 points, scored 20 goals, only conceded 4 goals. 3 players have scored 2 goals apiece for them. And then 23-year-old winger Mikel Oyarzabal, who will probably get a big move somewhere after this season, has 6 goals. 4 of them are on penalty kicks, and he has a non-penalty expected goals of 2.3. So yeah, he's doing pretty well, playing up to expectations. 28-year-old midfielder Porto has scored 4 goals. 25-year-old goalkeeper Alex Ramiro has 5 clean sheets in their 9 matches. Good and pretty young back line with Andoni Garasabal, 24 years old, Aritz Elostando, 26 years old, Robin Lenormand at 27, and Eihen Munoz at 23. Also, they have Nacho Monreal, the veteran formerly of Arsenal, who's playing really well in their back line.
It's a great accomplishment. And now we have to get to some housekeeping, Rusty, which is, if you are listening in your car or on a radio, please stay with us online on Facebook on your WWDB AM app or just ask Alexa to play WWDB. WWDB now concludes its broadcast day. WWDB is licensed to operate on an 8-60 kilohertz in Philadelphia with studio locations in Bala Cynwyd. WWDB is owned and operated by Beasley Media Group licensee, LLC. So with that, Rust, the other things, of course, are Real Madrid's in fourth, 5 wins, 1 loss, and 2 draws. Good start. And Barca, of course, and you got to them. By the way, the reason we haven't mentioned games to watch of the week, it's an international break. There is nothing really to watch tomorrow at all. And there's some scattered international matches through the rest of the week. I think England-Belgium is on this weekend, which might be the best of the bunch. Two teams that are very good and have a lot of depth. So with that,
I think the United States and Wales play on Thursday, by the way.
Okay. Well, that would be a good one to watch, too, is this time the U.S. caught up all its international players, which is why you won't see MLS players. So that should be interesting. So should we get to Ligue 1?
I think we should. You've been following it pretty closely. Watched PSG beat Rennes this past weekend 3-0. What do you make of Ligue 1?
Sure. Well, and we'll take each of the leagues. We have three more to go in a couple of minutes. The standings, PSG in first with 24 points. Lille in second with 19. Rennes is in third with 18. Marseille in fourth with 18. Followed by four clubs with 17. Lyon, Monaco, Montpellier, and Nice. Biggest surprise has been the talk of firing Thomas Tuchel at PSG. Serious talk, apparently, after they lost last week in the group stage of Champions League to RB Leipzig 2-1 after losing Idrissa Gueye to a red card at the 69th minute. They also lost to Manchester United and find themselves in third place after three matches with 3 points behind both Manchester United and Leipzig. But here's the thing. The following players have been out with injuries. Kylian Mbappe, Neymar, Mauro Icardi, Juan Bernat, Theo Kehrer, Marco Verratti, Julian Draxler, Danilo Pereira, and Leandro Paredes. And in this weekend's match, they lost two players in the first half to injuries, and then Moise Keane went out limping in the second half, and he's played great. And is the performance group stage group disappointing? Sure, to lose to clubs like they have. But how many managers would be doing better with these injuries after losing its first two matches, Rusty, in Ligue 1? PSG has won 8 in a row, has scored 26 goals, and yielded only 3. So the disappointment is the paradox of the French league as a developer of talent, which they're great at, versus having any clubs mounting a serious challenge to PSG. Many teams have a few good players on the rise, but not enough to challenge PSG. And that's turning the French league, in my mind, into a Portuguese or Dutch league, save PSG, creating good young players and making money, which they will need to do now more than ever by selling young players for large sums, because even Lyon, once mighty Lyon, will have to do that, because when they took the break or they shut down the league when the pandemic hit, 17 of the 20 teams in the league had some financial issues. So with that, we'll go to the near neighbor of France, Germany. They played Der Klassiker this weekend. What happened? And what are the biggest surprises, disappointments, and stories coming out of the Bundesliga?
Right. So Bayern Munich and Borussia Dortmund, the two biggest clubs in Germany, two rivals. They went back and forth for most of the match, which ended 3-2 in favor of Bayern Munich. The biggest injury of the first half is that the star midfielder of Bayern, Joshua Kimmich, went down with a knee injury. He had surgery. He'll be out till January, unfortunately. But Marco Reus put Dortmund up right at the 45th minute. Only for a few minutes later in first half stoppage time, David Alaba equalized. And then Bayern Munich, as they do, came out smoking after the half. Robert Lewandowski scored at the 48th minute, and then Leroy Sané scored at the 80th minute to make it 3-1 to the visiting Bayern Munich. Erling Haaland got back in the 83rd minute to make it 3-2. Ended there, missed opportunity for Dortmund, but against a really good Bayern Munich team who just won the Champions League in August. It just shows Dortmund still have some players like Jadon Sancho who needs to get in gear. They're still sort of lacking that top-end world-class consistency that separates the likes of Robert Lewandowski and Thomas Müller and those guys from, you know, basically every other player in the world.
Rusty, is Robert Lewandowski the best striker in the world?
Right now, yes, he is the best number nine in the world. I think it's either him or Haaland, and yeah, I'd give the edge to Lewandowski for sure.
Haaland over Larry Kane, over Harry Kane?
Yes, because I think that Haaland scores more. I think that I think he's better physically as a striker. I think Kane, I think they're different players too. I think Kane is less of a poacher like Haaland is, and more someone who's going to go and join up with the buildup. Sometimes that ends up in goals, sometimes it doesn't. So yeah, they are different players, but I think that Dortmund do a really good job of getting Haaland into the best position for him to succeed on the pitch.
Well, I'm going to tell you you're wrong, only because I think Haaland has that potential. But Harry Kane is on pace to break Alan Shearer's record, I think, in the Premier League for most goals scored. And so I'll take Kane, but I'll take Lewandowski over Kane. I just think that he's a very good passer close up, too. But to Harry Kane's credit, he's come deeper to pair up with Heung-Min Son and doing a very good job for Tottenham. So, Rust, what are the surprises in the Bundesliga?
Yeah, so Union Berlin just promoted last year. They're in fifth place, second in goals scored with 16 plus 9 goal differential, yielding only one goal per game. And Hertha Berlin, in contrast, the rivals of Union Berlin, that's a team that we thought was going to be on the rise, but they're struggling. They're in 12th place with only 7 points in 7 matches, goal differential of 0. They've lost 4 games. And another surprise is that Bayer Leverkusen and Wolfsburg remain undefeated. They're usually toward the, like, in the top half of the table, but usually not that good. So we'll see if they can keep it up. And yeah, in terms of disappointments, Hertha Berlin, probably the biggest. Also Borussia Mönchengladbach, who oddly enough are playing pretty well in the Champions League, contrary to them being in seventh right now in the Bundesliga, which is slightly lower than they usually are.
Yeah, so, and the one thing for Bayer Leverkusen, which I think is a pleasant surprise, is they're playing pretty well there, I think, in fourth or fifth without Kai Havertz, who moved over to Chelsea. So Peter Bosz, their manager, is doing a very good job replacing Kai Havertz. So good report on the Bundesliga. Shall we go to Serie A?
Yeah, I mean, it's a competitive league. 7 matches out of 38 played so far. What are your impressions of it so far?
Well, Milan's in first with 17 points, still undefeated. Juve is undefeated too, but they have 4 draws and 3 wins. 8 teams have more than 12 points. Milan again in first with 17. Very surprising, Sassuolo second with 15, the Napoli and Roma with 14, Juve and Atalanta with 13, and Inter, Milan, and Verona with 12. Surprises, of course, Milan, who's rebuilding, we thought would take a little longer, and of course, Sassuolo. And Napoli is punching above its weight. They were down toward mid-table last season. Disappointments a bit early, but Atalanta needs to solve for problems on defense, although I expected a lot of goals to be scored in their match with Inter this weekend. It was a 1-1 draw.
So yeah, I was disappointed by that.
I watched
what
that entire match and came away like thunderstruck with disappointment. Juve seems a bit older and weaker than before. Inter gave us signs at the end of last season that they could contend for a Serie A title and even make a deep Champions League run, but they have 3 wins, 3 draws, and a loss, and they need also to get into gear. Now, they were without Romelu Lukaku. They put him at the end to try to jumpstart the offense, but there's a load management issue with all these players. And I thought in that match, Gianpiero Gasperini outcoached Antonio Conte as Atalanta came on strongly at the end, and they just couldn't convert, but they've given up a lot of goals this season, and for them to get a top four finish and to return to Champions League, they're going to have to do a bit better than that. So I had sloughed over, Rusty, or hand-waved by games to watch this week. And in fairness, because there is nothing on Wednesday, we're going to recommend that you watch the documentary Matthews on Amazon Prime. We had Ryan Scott Warren on, the director, earlier in the year during the pandemic break for a whole show, and he was fascinating about making this film. You can go back to our archives at www.wwwcinemaprime.com WDBAM.com to find it. This is Football on Prime, about the depth of the impact of soccer globally. And that's a multi-part series, as is Six Dreams, about players, managers, executives in La Liga. It's wonderfully crafted, and it talks about the importance of soccer in Spain. On Thursday, some international play. I would try Iceland versus Hungary or Paraguay versus Argentina. Some good players on those clubs. Friday, Venezuela, surprisingly better, versus Brazil, which is loaded. Saturday, France versus Portugal, which might be one of the best matches of the weekend. And then Sunday, Poland versus Italy, and then England versus Belgium, the latter of which could be a World Cup quarterfinal or semifinal in 2022. So with a few minutes to go, Rusty, prediction time. Who wins the English Premier League this season?
Gosh, that's a hard question.
Well, let's put that on the table. You can mull it over.
My heart wants to say Southampton, so I'll go with my heart just for the bants here and say Southampton. Who do you got?
Oh, I have Liverpool. Until somebody knocks that crown off of Liverpool's head, Liverpool's going to win it. I think Jurgen has them mobile, agile, and hostile. Sadio Mane, I believe, is the best player in the Premier League. There are a lot of good ones, but he has the will. A little bit worry on the back line. We'll see if they make a move in the January transfer window. There haven't been reports that they've been in conversation with anyone. So I will take Liverpool. Let's go to the Bundesliga.
I think I agree with you.
Okay. Yeah. Who's going to win the Bundesliga?
This should not Bayern Munich again.
Yes, I think hands because, down.
Yeah, because until, as you said about Liverpool, until someone knocks their crown off, I don't see them.
They've won so many years in a row, and that's then moved to Ligue 1. Who's going to win that?
Wow, I wonder. Probably the team that's owned by an entire country. I'm going to go with PSG for that.
Yeah,
right?
We're joking only because of the fact that with PSG and also with Bayern Munich, they're the best teams by far in their leagues. La Liga is going to be a different story. Who do you think is going to win La Liga? Can Real Sociedad hold on?
I'm going to go with Atletico Madrid. I think Joao Felix has been playing like crazy this year. He's been so good. And I think that defense is going to win the championship in that league this year. And no one's better at that than Atletico.
They're fantastic. I agree with you there. And what about Serie A, last but not least? Will Juventus win its 10th straight or 11th straight Scudetto or not?
Nah. You know what? I'm going to go with Napoli, because the fact that they're this good and they've already been docked or they already had to forfeit a game because of COVID cases shows that they're doing pretty well. So I think that they'll be able to build on how they've started. They got through that adversity. I think Napoli are going to win it.
Okay, and I want to take Juventus. Heavy is the head that lies the crown. Someone's got to knock it off of them, too. With that, we've got to go. Next week, we'll have Eric Krakauer as our guest. He is the play-by-play guy for La Liga and Ligue 1 on BN Sports. We'd like to thank Erica Shear and Mark McKenzie of the Philadelphia Union. Brett Kronberger with the new mask, the man behind the glass. For Rusty, this is Rich. This is Unexpected Goals on 860 AM Talk 860 in Philadelphia. Have a great day.